Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Thank you for joining us in this, the latest edition of the OIES podcast series. My name is David Adesma, and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme at the Institute, and it's my great pleasure to be joined today by three good friends, Michael Maiden, who's director of the Gas and China Programmes at the Institute, Anders Hove, who's research associate, and Philip Andrew Speed, who's a research fellow at the OIS. And we're here today to discuss the key messages that came out of their recent paper, interestingly titled, Software versus Hardware, How China's Institutional Setting Helps and Hinders the Clean Energy Transition. And this was published by the Institute in early December. Now, just to timestamp this recording, in an ever-changing market, we're recording this podcast on the morning of London time of Monday, the 6th of December, 2021. Michael, Anders and Philip, it's really great to have you back on the OIS podcast series. Now, Michael, can I perhaps start with you by asking about the title of the paper? You know, why did you and your co-authors decide to write the paper? And what do you mean by the software of the energy transition? And what is software and hardware? Can you perhaps share that with our listeners, Michael?
Of course. I mean, this is a paper that has been brewing for, I would say, almost a year now. We started thinking about it just after the after President Xi Jinping announced the what's now called the 30-60 targets, right? To peak carbon emissions by before 2030 and to reach net zero by 2060. And at the time, there were lots of questions about, well, is this serious? Is China committed? And can China do this? And so we thought to look at the institutional framework and what does that tell us about, is China better placed because of its institutions and governance than perhaps Western governments to achieve the energy transition? And in our discussions, we started discussing, you know, the hardware that China has historically been very good at, you know, the state-oriented system that lends money through state-owned banks to, well, big companies, and it's been really good at building stuff, right? Wind and solar grids and all of their economics. And of course, all the questions about market institutions and institutional planning. And then we came to the question, and you know, because the energy transition is society-wide and a very deep transformation, the questions of the software, the market mechanisms, the, you know, the need to work between sectors and the need to change habits pretty profoundly. And so we tried to look at, again, where historically China's been very good at the hardware, perhaps not so good at the software, and how likely is that to change going forward with enough government commitment, perhaps, to this process.
Now, thank you for that explanation. I thought we were going to be talking about IT for a minute, so I'm really pleased we're going to be talking about China. Well, look, Anders, can I come to you now? Can you share with us your high-level findings in the paper? Because I gather it's not a yes or no as to whether China's software helps or hinders the energy transition.
That's right. And the hint is right in the title, which is that the institutional setting helps and hinders the clean energy transition. Now, the paper is not a review article per se, but we do review a lot of the academic literature as well as some other sources about institutions in the energy transition, different perspectives worldwide. And kind of the point is that we, standing where we are 2021, we don't know what institutions are perfectly suited for a clean energy transition. We only have a few examples of transitions that have gone quite far already, and those might not be so relevant for a huge country in China's circumstances. But what we can do is review some of this existing literature about the different types of institutions and about the particular institutional characteristics in China. And when we say, you know, institutions and software, we're talking about things like the technology innovation system, social organization, law, international cooperation institutions, as well as institutions of government, institutions that are related to the organization of the economy that Michal already mentioned. So lest you think I'm avoiding answering by saying both, I think that the literature does point to some specific areas where these institutions, the way that they are currently existing and the trends in China, are helping in specific ways and hindering in some other ways.
Okay, so Philip, you know, perhaps you can kind of add on to what Anders has just said and share some of the findings of the paper. What about the policy institutions, you know, where China's kind of introduced this phrase, institutional advantage?
Well, David, it certainly has an institutional advantage in many ways. And all countries have institutional strengths and institutional weaknesses. China's institutional strength comes from the strength of the party state, its ability to lead in a top-down manner, to set targets, to put incentives that sometimes are economic, but they're often bureaucratic through the party system. And an advantage that most countries don't have, it's got lots of money in the banks and in the government that it can throw directly or through subsidies at different activities. And this can happen both at central and local government levels. So if we just look at how they've become a world leader in solar PV, yes, there were targets for deployment, but there was also ambitions to be a major provider of solar PV panels. And so central and local governments put subsidies and other forms of support along the full length of the supply chain, from research and development through to deployment. And it can do this in many spheres, as we describe in the paper. The problem they have is what one might politely call coordination. And so you, in such a large country, you have a lot of players. Even in central government level, you have multiple ministries. Then you've got at least four levels of government. You have state-owned enterprises. And both local government and state-owned enterprises have the ability to either support and enact or to undermine and prevent the inaction of central government policy. And sometimes we see one, like with solar PV, and sometimes we see another, as we did a few years ago, with the dispatch of renewable energy. So you've got strengths, which is huge power at the top, and weaknesses, which in many cases are other actors who will screw things up.
What about the kind of the organization of the energy sector and market? You know, how does that play out?
Well, the energy sector, really right from 1949, has been dominated by the state. And despite lots of talk about markets, listing of state-owned enterprises on international and local stock exchanges, most actors in the energy industry, both energy production and large-scale energy consumption, are owned wholly or partly by the state at central or local government levels. And despite some liberalization of some prices, the government, central government, retains the right to engage in that market and set prices or set bands in which those prices fluctuate. And also local governments, again, if we talk about interfering in policies, retain the power to obstruct the effective implementation of, or effective operation of markets. Now, you know, Xi Jinping has said innovation is the key to China's future and it is the key to the low carbon transition. But if the state-owned companies are the key energy players, then we have to ask, are they good at innovation? And the answer is generally no.
And as I can come back to you and build upon the innovation point, which Philip's just talked about, because there are seemingly a lot of different ideas floating about China's capacity based on its rapidly scaling up of EV and solar, as well as R&D patenting. What are your views on that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And there is this huge literature on technology innovation and technology catch-up, technology diffusion that we drew on in this paper. And a lot of that literature relates specifically to China's successful scale-up of solar and batteries, as you mentioned, and looks at the characteristics of technologies as well as the characteristics of institutions to see what sort of characteristics a country would need to continue this energy transition, which China has already well begun. And I thought I'd just list a few of those characteristics out here. One of them is adaptive capacity, which clearly was one of the factors that enabled China to rapidly scale up and reduce the cost of manufacturing in certain technologies. There's also the clear policies and clear legitimacy for new clean energy fields, which the central government, through its policy guidances, which are becoming increasingly low carbon oriented, has laid the path for. There's also the type of technologies that China would need in order to become a truly low carbon economy. And what this literature does seem to suggest is that the more manufacturing-intensive technologies, such as solar and batteries, do lend themselves exactly to China's advantages in terms of speed, in terms of supply chain efficiency, and in terms of the capital-intensive nature of building out these technologies, as opposed to those design-intensive technologies or customer-oriented technologies or more network technologies where it might require constant interaction and innovation among many different stakeholders, including kind of bottom-up consultation with many different parts of society. Those would be quite dramatically different from technologies like solar, which are quite modular and manufacturing intensive. I think it's an interesting perspective that we can say that it's not whether China is good or bad at innovation, but what the characteristics of technologies are and then how well they interact with the institutions on the ground in each country.
Well, so Philip, can I come to you now? Would you like to comment on kind of perhaps the more legal aspects of the energy transition?
Yes, well, I mean, because of the, let's say, this very top-down administrative command and control approach of the government, and because of the nature of the legal system, which is really dominated by the Communist Party, the law per se has very little impact on the low carbon transition to date. And I think you've got a 2015 updated law on environmental protection allows registered Chinese NGOs to bring public interest litigation against polluting enterprises, though they can't do the same against government agencies. However, this doesn't seem to take anybody anywhere, because I think carbon dioxide is not recognized as a pollutant by the law and the general regulations under the law. And the Chinese NGO called Friends of the Nature filed cases in 2016 against grid companies of Gansu and Ningxia on the grounds that they failed to purchase all the available wind and solar energy in their jurisdiction. But these cases have gone absolutely nowhere. So there's no evidence that the legal system, other than the top-down sort of command and control, that the legal system per se is really really affecting the implementation of government policy.
Mikhail, can I come to you? Because I'm sure, you know, you and I have been talking, you've got some kind of views on this. Would you like to add any comments?
I mean, one thing I wanted to address, and I know Anders will talk about it a bit more as well, is that the scaling up of, you know, the manufacturing intensive technologies was really facilitated by a world of huge amount of communication and collaboration between the West and China. And these transfers of ideas, of technologies have, where two slightly different, to say the least, governance systems were able to come together and lead to an acceleration of the energy transition. We have to recognize that without the massive cost reductions that China was able to produce in wind, solar, and batteries, the energy transition would not be where it is today. But going forward, are we still on a similar kind of track? I think is an open question, not just in terms of China's capabilities and Chinese governance is changing, but also its relations with the West are changing.
Okay, well, Anders, can I ask perhaps to build on that? You know, what about civil society and international organization? You know, what's your views on that?
Yeah, I think that for both of these, as Mikhail alluded to, it really there have been important roles for both civil society and international cooperation on environment and on energy transition. And I think that that has a really important role to play when we look into the future, because we might imagine that as the energy transition moves from a niche technologies such as solar and wind, which are just in one sector, to affecting more areas of daily life and really becoming a more of a dominant field of low carbon technology interacting with more parts of our daily lives, that we would expect there to be more need for interaction. And previously, the environmental space and energy policy spaces had been a very, I would say, almost a protected area where there was room for civil discourse and debate, and where I think NGOs in particular had been able to comment on new upcoming regulations. And I think that as China has actually taken some ideas from the bottom up and implemented them and responded to them, and also taken up the cause of climate change as very much its own, it will be interesting to see how that might adapt and change now that climate change and addressing climate change is a matter of top high-level policy and therefore potentially more sensitive.
Okay, can I come back to you, Mikhail, if I may, because you've told us about some of the helps and hindrances, but on the whole, would you say you've reached a positive or a negative conclusion?
The joys of an academic paper, not being in consultancies anymore, is that we can very clearly say, well, neither. And I think at the beginning, we did want to try and come out with one or the other, but we just couldn't. And I think, to me, the interesting outcome of this paper is really that we know that all countries have institutions that are both a help and a hindrance. And as Anders said at the very beginning, we don't have good examples of a perfect energy transition. And in that respect, there are also lots of shared challenges, despite the different governance and institutional systems. Obviously, the urgency to move forward is clear, but we didn't really seek to compare China to other countries. The helps, the hindrance are not criticisms, but it is a better way to understand and inform the processes. And I go back to our starting point, which is, can China do, because China is a centralized system, will it do better? Or is it, it's highly likely to do better. But similarly, we've had assertions that because China doesn't have market institutions, it is doomed to fail. So I think one of the things that we also tried to highlight is, it's complicated and we need to understand various factors. As we've pointed out, there are clear strengths. But I think the energy transition will also shift the way institutions in China operate. We're seeing already the adoption of electricity markets that was accelerated rapidly after the energy crisis now, and things like distributed energy. The other thing we wanted to do is really set this out as a framework for future research, because some of the things that we've discussed very briefly here today as well highlighted, many areas of discussion for us. What is the aim of reform? And are we looking at, or does the Chinese government and does the energy transition need effectiveness? Or does it need economic efficiencies? And to what degree can it use a bit of both? And I think these are questions that will continue to be important to observe as we look at China and the energy transition more broadly going forward. But for us, of course, as we look at China, there are questions around innovation, the types of innovation that China can, that China is sort of more amenable to doing, and how that will shift with and without international collaboration. And another question that we touch upon briefly in the paper is sort of how incumbents fit in. And I think, again, that's a massive question going forward. Can state-owned companies, which are key actors in China's political economy, how do they adapt and do they adapt, right? When we think about the energy transition, heavy industry, coal, oil, and even gas are supposed to be losers. Can the state in China lose? And so how does that, how do institutions and how does the political economy more broadly involve with this energy transition? So more questions than answers, but that is really what made this paper a fascinating paper to write.
Absolutely. I do like that line, can the state in China lose? I think subject we'll be having discussions for many years to come. Well, look, Anders, I'm going to come to you if I can for the last question, which I always like to be kind of forward-looking. Perhaps it's a difficult question, because in your paper you mentioned that this is a framework for thinking about governance. So how does this framework apply to the current developments in China's energy sector, the power crisis and the progress on 30-60 targets? But importantly, what do you think the future picture will look like?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And of course, it's the hardest one to answer. I think that what this paper is trying to do is bridge a little bit of a gap between what we saw from the literature on the energy transition outside of China, which tends to be very focused on a social transition, economy-wide transition that will really transform all of the economic players in the energy sector and how we interact with them, with the literature that we see coming out of the China energy transition, which is very much focused on just the technologies, the technology pathways, the relative proportions and efficiencies of those technologies without a lot of discussion of the institutional factors. And then when I think about the future and how this would or would not predict these future changes and future pathways of technologies, I think that what we can say is that looking at the experience to date, we would say that probably the success factors that have enabled China to be so excellent at scaling up some of the manufacturing that we've seen would not be the same success factors that would potentially make China successful overall in ultimately driving a low carbon energy transition. And in particularly, we've already alluded to the idea that China might experience more difficulty in some fields that require more thorough institutional changes or more interaction among stakeholders, things like energy efficiency, electricity markets, or sectors where you just need to have greater involvement of users or customers, or where you need more openness and transparency of information so that startups, disruptive technologies, and just new ideas that are coming from the bottom up can get into the innovation field and into those innovation pathways. And I think that in the there are clear examples in China where you see tech disruptions in areas of information technology, for example. So bike sharing, WeChat. But these were areas where there wasn't powerful incumbent that they were disrupting. Whereas in the energy field, when you think about distributed energy or smart grid or vehicle to grid, that could be disruptive for an existing industry where there could be very strong regime resistance. And I think that's where we see a little bit more of the challenge on an institutional level, on a software level, if you will.
Okay, well, may I say, you know, you've mentioned Anderson and Mikhail as well, you know, this is going to be the basis of future research. And we look forward to kind of hearing about that research over the coming year on this important subject. Well, look, you know, Mikhail, Anderson, Philip, you know, thank you so much for your time today. I've really enjoyed our conversation that builds on the messages from the paper Software versus Hardware, How China's Institutional Setting Helps and Hinders the Clean Energy Transition. I hope, you know, all of our listeners have enjoyed this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity, or China programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.